Big color, bigger savings. It's Sherwin-Williams' biggest super sale. Get 40% off paints and stains October 17th through the 27th with prices starting at $29.39. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is a True Crime in Real Time update from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Today, we're peeling back the layers on a case that quite frankly feels like a twisted dive into a real-life psychological thriller. I'm Tony Bruschi. Now, it's one thing to be accused, but to live for 13 months in what can only be described as a descent into madness, that's another realm altogether. This isn't just about guilt or innocence. It's about human rights, mental games, and a justice system that, depending on where you stand, might seem more medieval than modern. Accounts from the courtroom comes from one of our lead contributors, Bob Mata, from the podcast Defense Diaries, who has been in the courtroom every day. You see, Richard Allen, a man accused of unspeakable crimes, has been locked away under conditions that would break even the most hardened individuals. Solitary confinement, lights burning bright 24/7, never dimming, a relentless invasion of his psyche, constant video surveillance, stripping him of even the most basic semblance of privacy. His own space, a barren, claustrophobic cell, became his tormentor. And yet, through it all, he maintained his innocence, sometimes even to the disbelief of those who were supposed to help him. But the plot thickens when Dr. Walla steps into the frame. An experienced therapist, perhaps, but one whose interests in this case run deeper than professionalism. As it turns out, Dr. Walla wasn't just treating Richard Allen, she was consuming everything about his case. Engaging with true crime podcasts, listening to the theories, reading group discussions online, even going so far as to use restricted databases to learn more. And in the end, her testimony is now marred by accusations of bias and unethical behavior, as her private fascination with Allen's case could very well have compromised her work. On the stand, Walla admitted she followed Allen's case religiously long before she even met him. Defense attorney Brad Weber didn't hold back, laying out piece after piece of evidence that painted her in a damning light. Conflicted interests, inconsistent statements, and perhaps worst of all, whispers of state manipulation. Was she acting as an agent of the state, coaxing out confessions from a man who was deteriorating before her eyes without his lawyer present? That's the question hovering over this entire trial like a storm cloud. And then there are the confessions themselves, uttered by a man caught in a swirling storm of depression, anxiety, and isolation, 13 months in the darkest corner of the prison system. Were his words true admissions of guilt or the ramblings of a mind fractured by inhumane conditions? The defense argues they were forced, and when you hear the details of what Allen endured, you start to wonder, how much can the human mind take before it breaks, saying anything to escape the torment? Let's dig deeper into the conditions. Richard Allen, a pre-trial detainee, not a convicted criminal, mind you, was placed in solitary confinement with surveillance that would rival that of a dystopian novel. Locked away, denied normal inmate privileges, and monitored around the clock, even his most personal moments were under scrutiny. He lived under constant suspicion, with rules and protocols weaponized to crush his spirit. He had no access to proper orientation about prison life, no understanding of the rules that governed his every move. And those who did see him, like Dr. Walla, often found themselves trapped in their own conflicting narratives. But here's where the court drama intensifies. Brad Weber didn't just cross-examine Walla, he systematically took apart her credibility. You listen to true crime podcasts about this case, right? He asked. Yes, she admitted. You accessed restricted databases to learn more about a separate suspect? Again? Yes. And when it came to her interactions with Alan, the defense painted a picture of a therapist deeply compromised, one who blurred the lines between her personal obsessions and her professional duty. A woman who, after swearing to provide unbiased care, openly discussed case details from podcasts with her patient. It's hard to ignore the ethical ramifications. Was Walla inadvertently planting seeds of confession or even paranoia into Alan's mind, knowing what she knew from her off-duty true crime deep dives? Could her professional assessments be trusted, especially when she had publicly engaged with the case on social media and in crime groups? And then there are Alan's moments of supposed psychosis, reported as rolling on the floor, consuming his own waste, and masturbating in front of the camera. Dr. Walla claimed he might have been feigning these symptoms, but under cross-examination, she admitted the lines between real and acted psychosis blurred in a man treated like a caged animal. Alan's behavior, erratic and shocking, was also marked by brief moments of lucidity, leading to jury questions. Could someone switch in and out of psychotic states so quickly? Walla's hesitant answers left the room questioning everything. The defense drilled down on Alan's fragile mental state. Solitary confinement for 13 months is a recipe for psychological disaster, especially for a man with a history of major depressive disorder. Even the state's policy prohibits such prolonged isolation for mentally ill inmates, yet Alan remained trapped, his sanity unraveling. The defense painted a picture of a system hell-bent on breaking a man, innocent until proven guilty, yet treated as though he had already been condemned. Just as gripping were the revelations about evidence. Brad Weber, a property owner near the scene, came forward to confirm the timeline of his movements, with questions swirling about the van Alan mentioned in his statements. The defense attempted to dismantle the state's narrative, pointing out contradictions, muddled identifications, and the state's questionable attempts to link Alan's vehicle to the scene. The prosecutor's case seemed to rest on shaky ground, with evidence that shifted and adjusted as needed. Even the jury had their doubts. Questions arose about the vehicle evidence. Were the rims unique to Alan's car model? Was there any certainty in the footage? The defense's relentless pursuit of every inconsistency created a growing unease. How much of the case was built on assumptions and circumstantial evidence? But let's not forget the most unsettling question of all. Why was Richard Alan treated with such extreme measures? What drove the state to subject him to conditions that even convicted murderers rarely experience? As we peel back these layers, we're left wondering if this was a desperate attempt to extract a confession or something even darker lurking just beneath the surface. And as the state's case comes to a close, the defense gears up to challenge everything. They've subpoenaed witnesses, questioned timelines, and laid bare the brutal realities of Alan's confinement. Yet the looming phone call recordings could either seal his fate or blow the case wide open. Every new detail is another thread in this tangled web. 13 months. 13 long, excruciating months of isolation and solitary confinement for a man who is, according to the law, presumed innocent. And yet Richard Alan was subjected to psychological torment that most of us couldn't even fathom. We're talking about lights that never dimmed, cameras that invaded his every moment of privacy, in conditions that would test the mental fortitude of even the strongest among us. What strikes me the most is how his confessions, the supposed linchpins of the prosecution's case, came out under such extreme duress. It raises a glaring question. Can anything said by a man in such a shattered state of mind be considered reliable? If history has taught us anything, it's that false confessions are not uncommon when a person is pushed to their mental breaking point. Military captives, victims of psychological abuse, they all share stories of being coerced into admitting to things they didn't do just to make the suffering stop. And here we have Richard Allen, not a hardened criminal, but a man with a well-documented history of depression and anxiety, subjected to relentless pressure. How much of his supposed guilt is real and how much is the product of his own mind, desperate for an escape from his nightmare? And what about Dr. Walla? This case has taken an even darker twist with the revelation that the person entrusted with Allen's mental well-being was far from impartial. Walla's personal obsession with the case is more than a minor detail. It could be a damning factor. A therapist who follows the case on social media, engages with true crime podcasts, and even accesses restricted databases for her own curiosity. It's a gross breach of trust. How does one compartmentalize professional responsibility and personal intrigue when dealing with someone so vulnerable? Walla's actions blur the lines and beg the question, was Allen's treatment ever truly unbiased? From the defense's perspective, the question isn't just about whether Allen committed the crime, it's about whether he ever stood a chance in the face of such psychological warfare. And if Allen's treatment was more about breaking him than helping him, what does that say about the integrity of the entire investigation?
In a world where the darkest secrets lie just beneath the surface.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence says otherwise.
Where hidden killers roam unnoticed in the shadows.
I think you would definitely be looking at a blend of toxic, very bad narcissistic personality traits, and they will be vengeful and possibly resort to violence.
Join Tony Bruschi as he uncovers the truth behind the most chilling cases.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence clearly says otherwise.
Each episode, we dig deep into the minds of those who commit the unthinkable.
To your point on narcissism, he thinks in his own mind how witty he is.
Yeah.
But he lost that jury. I was done with him in 2 minutes.
From unsolved mysteries to infamous crimes.
Geez, you've just talked about how you taught yourself how to do everything under the sun. I bet you did a YouTube video, how to best kill somebody with a knife.
Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi takes you where few dare to go.
How does someone with such a dark secret go unnoticed for so long?
With multiple new episodes every single day.
We're not just telling stories, we're seeking justice.
Listen now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.